Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Prepper. If the word conjures up an image of a doomsday-obsessed extremist in a well-armed bunker or walled compound, well, you're not alone. Preppers don't have a great public image. But my next guest says they are a largely misunderstood group and that we could all learn a few things from preppers. Chad Huddleston is an adjunct assistant professor of anthropology at St. Louis University in Missouri and an instructor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. He's been studying preppers for a decade, and somewhere in there, he became one himself. He recently wrote about all this in the magazine Sapiens. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do those stereotypes of extremist preppers get wrong?
Well, the basic stereotype of preppers being doomsday preppers, first and foremost, is mostly incorrect. The idea that they're waiting for some apocalyptic event certainly is a little overblown. The preppers I've worked with are definitely more worried about local events, your house burning down, for instance, or storms or power outages during the summer or the winter. Those are things that you can prepare for. They fully admit that if there's a large apocalyptic event or large societal breakdown or something like that, that's nothing. You can't prepare for that. But you can prepare for anything below that in severity. And so people should be more prepared for those events that they can kind of become their own first responders for, if you will, so that they're not left out in the cold or, you know, without any of the gear that they absolutely need to survive, you know, for a few days until real first responders or local government or Red Cross gets there to assist them. So those kinds of stereotypes that get thrown around or, you know, we see on TV make it difficult for people that are prepared or want to prepare to kind of do that out in the open without being, you know, looked down upon, basically.
And yet, a lot of us, at least in the Northeast, at the beginning of every summer, will put together a hurricane box. We're urged to do that by government officials. I mean, maybe all of us should be considering ourselves preppers.
Correct. And it is really, gear is one thing, but in my research, what I've found is that it's really about your attitude. It's an adaptive attitude to adverse conditions. So, you know, putting together that hurricane box or, you know, putting an extra blanket and some food and water in your car when it's going to be winter. Or, you know, people in California that might have a bag for fires that they need to get out or any of those kinds of things. Or even if you just have good camping gear and know how to use it in a first aid kit, that's all prepping kind of mentality stuff. But it's the idea that you're not doing it for a specific event, but it's just in case anything happens. That's where we kind of make the leap to a prepper. And some people, again, because of those stereotypes, don't want to make that leap because that's what makes it seem crazy. Like if you have that gear and, you know, 3 months of food and water in your basement, suddenly now you're outside the bounds. So it's that in-between part of what's considered acceptable or normative in our society that kind of borders that edge of, you know, the so-called doomsday prepper versus the person that's just ready for, you know, for that next event that's bound to happen.
Your insights into what constitutes a prepper and where some of these negative stereotypes come from is born of a decade of research as an anthropologist. What got you started on this?
I was actually finishing my PhD on something completely different, sacred land in New Zealand, in anthropology. And there's a group local to my region that is quite visible. So I saw them on the highway, actually, and thought, this is a strange-looking vehicle. It looks kind of military, but it's not military. And there's this weird symbol on the side. So I looked it up, and I thought, oh, this is really interesting and odd. And that was about the time that the show Doomsday Preppers came out on Nat Geo. So I was kind of aware of that. But as I said, I was finishing my PhD, so all that went on back burner. But as soon as I was done with that, just personal interest, you know, I grew up here around St. Louis area in Missouri and spent a lot of times outdoors as a child and through my growing up camping and hunting a bit. And so I've always been interested in outdoors stuff. And there was a group talking about outdoor stuff and gear. And so I just went to a meeting and pretty soon I realized that, you know, after looking around online that no one was interested in these people. Here's a show that's talking all about them. Here's this group that's doing the things locally. So my personal interest emerged very quickly into professional interest to see if these people were indeed, you know, crazy or apocalyptic minded or conspiracy theorists, which is all kind of the stereotype. And I quickly found out that none of those things were the case.
Chad Huddleston, as you said, your research debunks a lot of the stereotypes about preppers But one thing that's interesting, you say they do tend to be kind of secretive about what the supplies are that they have. Mm. What kinds of supplies might they not want to divulge having, and what have you learned about why?
Some of that is about firearms. And all of the people that I know that have firearms, not all of them do, but they're legal gun owners. You know, they do practice with them. They do really, really stress safety, and they're not violently minded or militia minded or anything like that. They're very, safety minded and legally owning these firearms. But that's the kind of thing that you don't necessarily want to tell other people, because they do get stolen. But also over and above that, things like food and water and generators and other gear that people might have. The idea behind kind of being secretive, especially where it might be read by lots of other people, there might not be so secretive within the group, but outside of the group, is that, if something were to happen, then everyone's going to know where the food and water is.
Party at my place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So, the few things that we've seen here in this region, mostly power out, extended power outages, flooding especially, they do tend to share their gear and their food and water and their expertise, not only with their neighbors, but with local, first responders, local government groups, local NGOs. They're there to help. They're right there helping too, and have the knowledge. So they're more than willing to share that.
And you also point out that it's not just stuff. That a lot of preppers, one of the biggest things that they're stockpiling is knowledge and skills.
And that's one of their kind of sayings that they talk about is, the more you know, the lighter your bag. So it's, again, about that adaptive attitude that you don't need, an 80-pound pack with all this gear in it if you know how to, kind of look at the landscape and figure out what tools you can use and how to use them in multiple situations. So that knowledge is the utmost important thing. And that was another thing that really spurred me into looking into the couple groups that I did in the St. Louis region, is that they really stressed the skill, so much so that one of their mandates is you cannot talk about politics, you cannot talk about religion, you cannot use disaster as a metaphor for those groups or people or issues that you don't like. We are talking about actual disasters. So that drew me in because I think there are a lot of people that get hung up on the ideology and miss the point of learning the skills.
Chad Huddleston, as an anthropologist, I imagine that these negative perceptions of preppers are almost as interesting as the preppers themselves. What have you learned about what generates those negative ideas about preppers?
For me, I think it directly extends back to especially the 80s and early 90s with the survivalist and militia movements that were very politically active and very obvious in events like Waco and Ruby Ridge and, of course, the Oklahoma City bombing. Those people were all kind of anti-government militia groups, are members of or associated with them. And so that was, that kind of political isolationist and religious ideology often that guided those groups. That really got into the public consciousness because they became such huge events, those three in particular. So a lot of people looked to those as touchstones for what the movement would be. But luckily, after those events, most of those militias, a lot of the people that tried to join those kinds of groups weren't actually interested in separating from the government or committing violence. So as soon as they saw that, some people were willing to do that, they, as with most extremist groups, they backed away and those kind of movements died. Even though I've never been able to trace down exactly where the term prepper came from or where it was first used, that is certainly the reason that a lot of groups started using it, to get away from all that kind of past baggage of, we want to learn these survival skills, but we don't want, we're not politically affiliated, we're not religiously or ideologically affiliated, we just want to learn the skills. So that's where the word kind of came into use, it seems. But all that baggage, it's really hard to get rid of that in the public consciousness. So people see that you have gear and you're talking about, possible adverse events, and they automatically associate that with survivalists. So it's hard, even though they're working hard and, for a long time now to separate themselves, it's hard to do that because all we hear, again, doomsday preppers on Nat Geo and other shows like that, without the separation, which is where I tend to find myself talking at conferences about that very thing.
You mentioned that a lot of current day preppers don't necessarily want to publicly broadcast their identity as a prepper. They don't want to associate with those negative images and perhaps bring those stereotypes on themselves. But is there any movement to create a new identity that presents a different kind of public face?
I think, especially in the past, I would say 4 or 5 years, there's been many more stories about preppers in various publications and, you know, podcasts like this and radio shows and all kinds of things that do paint them as much more, you know, regular people that are worried about, you know, certain things, you know, given their region, and worried about the safety of their family. And especially after Katrina, and a lot of the preppers I know focus on Katrina as a point that this is clearly something, an event that happened that our government and NGOs and aid organizations were not prepared for.
And since then, Harvey Correct. And Maria, the wildfires, I mean, obviously Yep. we've seen a lot of devastating natural disasters in the
Exactly.
past several years.
On and on. And initially I thought, oh, it's going to be about 9/11, like the terrorist attack, that's going to be the thing that everyone looks to. But that was not it at all. It was the so-called natural disaster that did it, where, you know, like still something like 65% of the U.S. public thinks that if something were to happen to them, like one of those disasters, that a first responder would be at their door in 24 hours to help them. That's simply not the case. It might be 48, it might be 72. They'll probably get there eventually, but people don't often take that into account. Like they're some kind of superheroes. So again, this is where it's good to have a 3-day bag or a 4-day bag or a 5-day bag so that you're not necessarily a victim right away. You can kind of respond to your circumstances until someone there, you know, a larger organization can come and help you. So those stories are coming out more and more. And because there's now an economy behind prepping, there's lots and lots of businesses that are out there that, you know, you can spend as much money as you want, as, you know, buying your own bunker or buying your own gear or buying your own island or moving to New Zealand or whatever you want to do. There's someone out there to facilitate all of that. So as that becomes more kind of mainstream and people are making money doing that, then there's more stories about it.
I wonder, is this whole phenomenon of preparing for disasters, I mean, even having the awareness that there might be disasters to come, and then also having the means to potentially prepare for them, is this a uniquely modern phenomenon, or has this sort of thing been part of cultures in the past?
I would argue that there's a long line of historically minded folks or situations and cultures around the world that do this very thing. And in a lot of societies in the past, the deeper past, that might have been as simple as sitting around the camp, usually in the winter, and telling stories about survival and how to get through certain conditions. And, you know, kind of the idea of, oh, back in the winter of so-and-so, this is what we had to do to survive. But those things aren't only stories. They're also lessons. And so you tell them the same, you know, year after year, and they become, that's the body of knowledge. So we find those kinds of stories world around. So there's lots of disaster anthropologists around the world that are starting to collect those kinds of stories and those ideas from native groups or indigenous groups around the world. And then we can think back to, you know, a lot of the skills that people, that preppers are trying to get now are skills that most people had back in, you know, the farm era where most people lived on family farms. You know, they knew how to preserve food, they knew how to hunt, they knew how to work with their hands because that's what they did on a daily basis. Now that we're mostly an urban society, all those things have been lost for practical reasons. We don't all need to know how to, you know, hunt and gather and make things necessarily because we can just buy them for the most part. So going back and learning those skills has been a little bit of a struggle for all of us. Again, and it's not like you get to practice them if you live in your apartment in Manhattan, you know, hunting and gathering all that much. So it's kind of hard to do. But that skill, you know, could help you survive at some point. So it has to be a creative process.
Chad, you came at this from a research perspective initially and then became a prepper yourself. I wonder, what are the lessons that you think all of us could stand to learn from preppers?
Cool. The lessons I think that people should learn and need to learn are really simple things that we do hear from various organizations like the fire department, like, you know, just the idea of changing the batteries in your smoke detector. We don't think of that as a big deal until your house catches fire. and having a flashlight in case the power goes out, or having a first aid kit, and not just having a first aid kit, but knowing how to use what is in that first aid kit. And also, in addition to that, not having more gear than you know how to use, but also simply having a bug out bag, which now Homeland Security, the Red Cross, FEMA, they all advocate for you to have, you know, the absolute necessary things that you need to have, especially if you're on any kind of medication or, you know, need certain foods if you're diabetic or something, to have those things available just in case something happens. And so you can get through, again, for that 3 or 5 day period. The other thing that didn't occur to me, and it's so simple, is having copies of like your driver's license or your house information or your car information, you know, all your insurance information. In case your house burns down, you have copies of all that stuff. So simply having copies of those things in your, maybe your passport, your ID, in your bug out bag, those kinds of very simple lessons are the biggest thing, I think, for most people.
Well, I've got a blanket in the trunk of my car, but it sounds like I've got some other work to do at home before I'm a true prepper. Chad Huddleston is an adjunct assistant professor of anthropology at St. Louis University in Missouri and an instructor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Join us next week as we tackle what everyone needs to know about food and nutrition. Diets and weight loss are consistently at the top of Americans' lists of New Year's resolutions, so we thought we'd debunk some common myths and dive into the science behind some of the latest fads and buzzwords. Until then, you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Living Lab Radio, and I'm at H. Goldstone. Happy New Year, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.